I keep going back to November, December. I happened to be watching CNBC at a moment when one of our prominent fixed income heads at one of the big banks was saying that right now the market is focused on Chair Powell's pause and telegraphing of 3 rate cuts for 24. Right. And yeah. And the idea was that, you know, the statement that was made, which was bold, was that the market will test, you know, will try and test 3.5 on the 10 years, on the 10-year US Treasuries. Right. And then when there's a resumption back on focusing on economic fundamentals, then the market will start to look again at the economy and we could test 5%.
Right.
Right.
We're close.
You know, that call was bang on.
Yeah.
And I think about, you know, at the moment in time when he said it, it was, you know, wow, that's quite a call, you know. But it just goes to the volatile environment that we're in, with regards to the economy, with regards to inflation, with regards to rates, with regards to, you know, how things unfold, you know, from that moment in time till now. And, you know, now, of course, the Fed has walked back its rate cuts. You know, we had one Fed president after another, you know, trotted out onto the media on, you know, Fox Business, CNBC, BN, you know, Bloomberg. They're even talking about the chance that there might be one more rate hike in the offing. Right.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they're just trying to keep us honest with that. But
there's a lot of rhetoric, right? There's a lot of positioning, creating optionality for the Fed, given the market that we're in. But the bond market, of course, has reacted very badly to the walking back of the rate cuts, and now we see the 10-year and the 30-year in the 4.7 handle. How long that lasts is anyone's guess. But
yeah.
But, you know, reversing all of December's gains, backing out 6 to 8 rate cuts that it had factored in the excitement of Chair Powell's presser. On top of that, now we've got four of the magnificent that are not so magnificent anymore, magnificent yeah. 7 stocks.
We're slowly getting to 1.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of pressure now, right? Because fundamentals... Yeah. Fundamentals are playing a role. And of course, so is narrative. You know, we saw that with Meta this week. So we're at this pivotal moment, it feels like. Equity and bond volatility has, you know, gone up in the last month. What do you make of it? Are we going to get our cut on this year?
Yeah, well, okay. So I think as far as the Federal Reserve goes and their cut, I mean, they've gone from 7 rate cuts earlier this year, right? They pivoted psychologically, yeah. at least in mid-December last year. We go from 7 to 6 to 3 to 2, and now we're at 1. I think we will get the cut. It's probably going to be much later on than what people expect. I mean, that's really what this is all about. And even if they cut once, it's, you know, people have this recency bias because we've seen rate hikes go boom, boom, yeah. boom, boom, all quickly stacked up. That's not what the Fed's really talking about. And what they're talking about is cutting, pausing for a long time, seeing how that really gets integrated into the markets and the economy, and then cutting again if necessary. So it's going to be like a cut, long pause yeah. again. And if we get anything different, that means we're in trouble. If we get cut, 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 that means that the economy is really suffering, and we don't want that. So I don't see relief at this point because there's a yep. lag to their actions. I think we could see the economy stumbling a little bit later on this year.
Yeah. And if you wait, history shows that if you wait for a cut to be risk on, put more money to work in risk assets, if you wait for the cut, that's generally way too late. When the reality actually sets in, you're right. If there's a sudden massive, you know, if there's a series of rate cuts that come, you know, sort of concurrently very close together, then there'll be reason to worry that the economy has slowed down. An alarming reaction to the economy would not be positive for the market at that point.
Absolutely. And we're seeing, you know, the problem with this market right now is we're seeing a lot of mixed signals. And it's very difficult for everybody to make, you know, heads or tail of this because you know, we're seeing this even in the economy. We're seeing, you know, a weaker GDP in the U.S. And Canada's actually been fairly weak for a while on the GDP front. You know, we haven't dipped into the negative numbers, you know, two times in a row. But, you know, here we are, you know, fairly weak. But the U.S. actually, we saw that recent number come in for the GDP, which was weaker than that's expected. Right. And inflation is a bit higher than we expect. So that's that combination is not a good combination overall. And that's making the Federal Reserve's job more difficult. But even at the, you know, at the personal level, you know, if we take a look at what's happening in the economy and consumption patterns, it's very difficult because we're seeing credit card defaults rise. We're seeing car repossessions rise. We're seeing bankruptcies rise. And so we're seeing a lot of these high frequency signals that are occurring. And yet, on the other hand, we've seen, you know, flight traffic increase,
right,
you know, and be healthy, and international flights go up in price and hotels go up in price. It's like, wow, what's going on? And a lot of that has to do with, I think, you know, what happened back in with the COVID stimulus and how the money was distributed throughout the economy. And, you know, so people going, well, how come these people are not doing so well in the economy and this other group is?
Well, there's that bifurcation, so, right? I mean, I think the yeah, investor class is doing just fine, but the rest are not doing nearly as well. But I think there's also a dichotomy, you know, so there's this bifurcation in the economy. There's also, like, I feel for Canadians because, you know, when we watch, you know, US business news, we get one picture. And when we watch Canadian business news, it's a little more somber, right? And, you know, like we keep having the same, you know, a lot of the discussion sort of revolves around how U.S. consumers have 30-year mortgages and Canadian consumers have at best 5-year terms. And you know, so a U.S. consumer that locked in a couple years ago, not that long ago, I mean, things have happened very quickly. But if you were a U.S. mortgagee and you locked in a couple of years ago, you know, you got a mortgage in the two handle, right? Now it's 6-7, right? But who's renewing their mortgage right now if they don't have to? Nobody. Not there, and not in the U.S. No. Anyway. But we've got this lumpiness that's going to start making its way through, you know, the banking system here and through, you know, that's going to be affecting consumers. So the Canadian outlook's very different from the U.S. outlook, and it's like a tale of two cities, right? To your point, I think as a remnant psychologically of COVID is this now or never mentality, which is, you know, I've got the money, I'm going to spend it now. If I don't do it, you know, things could turn, and then I won't be able to. And people are traveling who maybe they shouldn't be traveling because of, you know, financial reasons, but they are because they don't want to miss out. And so you've got that pent up demand for experiences and travel and vacation, and it just makes for a lot of uncertainty, a lot of question marks. Yeah,
it does, because everything's going, you know, it's we're moving in multiple directions as far as that goes. And if we take a look at what's happening in the States, you're absolutely right. You know, if you've locked in a 2% mortgage, you know, back a couple of years ago, you know, you're staying in the house as long as you can. And there's a lot of homeowners did that. Some didn't, but a lot did. Now, it's not just the mortgage costs as far as the house goes, because there are HOA fees and there's insurance, and those have been going up a lot in the States, but they're still going to hang on. And I don't think that's really going to have an impact. I think everything hinges on the unemployment rate.
Right.
Because if unemployment goes up, starts to really go up, we're still really below those thresholds that we really look at. That's critical. Like in Canada, you know, normally our unemployment band is anywhere from 6-8%. We're just into that right now, at the lower end of that. So we're not even halfway into that right now. So we're still kind of low. And the U.S. is too. I mean, they're trading below their 4% level. You know, they really start to worry when it starts to get closer to 5. So I think the psychology, I think you're absolutely right, that people will spend money as long as they can.
Right.
And that has a momentum, some sort of inertia taking place, especially after COVID. It's when something else changes and everybody takes a step back and goes, whoa, maybe I should be looking at this a little different. You know, maybe John's lost his job down the street and I've seen more of this. they start to get concerned.
Well, and it's so confusing, I think, too, right? Because like another source of confusion might be like if you're watching financial news or even just, you know, regular news where they're talking about these things, they're saying that you know, you keep hearing the economy is doing better than we thought. The economy's perform, you know, it's more robust than we thought. It's more resilient than we thought. We're not going into a recession like we thought we would. The inverted yield curve, you know, we're now 18 months into an inverted yield curve. And so far, you know, Cam Harvey's indicator hasn't really, like, you know, it hasn't panned out yet, but it doesn't mean it won't, right? It's just
right.
The day that Americans and Canadians alike, the day that we hear that the economy is starting to suffer, that it's starting to soften up, that's when maybe the psychology, the opposite, you know, the psychology of fear kicks in, and it's no longer fear of missing out. It's fear of, you know, what if I lose my job, as you said. So,
yeah, no, I absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, and you're right. The media keeps saying, hey, look, you know, inflation's not that bad. And we're measuring, you know, inflation with using CPI, which has all these hedonistic adjustments, you know, but the average person is going to the grocery store, you know, oh, shocks me when I go to the grocery store. I say, well, look how expensive this is. You know, this is not the inflation that's being reported in the CPI, and there's other components, and they just do all these different adjustments. And so they've changed the way they calculate inflation over time. And you know, if you go back and take a look at the way they did it in the 1980s or 1990s, our inflation rate would be up over 10%. But yet here we are at a much lower rate because we're making these adjustments, you know, whether product's improving, so therefore they say the product that you're getting has gone down in price because you're getting better value, or they take into account the substitutions or the way they calculate homeowners' equivalent rent. As well, it's not just, they don't go out and take a look at all the rental properties and say, what's the average rental price? That's not the way they do it. You know, they go out and talk to homeowners and say, you know, what could you rent your home for, type of thing. And, you know, so there's all these different adjustments, but the actual experience that people are feeling is much worse. And that's why it's much worse, because they're seeing inflation go up. They're seeing gas prices go up, and they're seeing all these events take place, and they go, well, the media may be saying that we're okay, but that's not the way I feel collectively. And so the experience has been different. And all that has to do with the way things are measured.
Yeah. So Brooke, I'm just going to kick off the show. Thank you for listening. I'm Pierre Daly, managing editor at advisoranalyst.com. And this is Insight is Capital. My special guest today is Brooke Thackeray. Brooke is a distinguished research analyst at Global X ETFs Canada, with over 18 years of rich experience in the investment industry, leveraging his profound knowledge and investing experience in the field of seasonal market trends and analysis to enhance market strategies for HAC, the Global X Seasonal Rotation ETF, as well as working with institutions on their strategies and helping them to improve their seasonal exposures. Brooke is also the author of Thackeray's 2024 Investing Guide, the authoritative annually updated guide to profiting from seasonal investing. Today, we're going to dive into Brooke's outlook, as well as some of the remarkable seasonal investing trends you can consider across U.S. and Canadian stocks and bonds. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Brooke, it's awesome to have you on the show again. I'm excited to get your unique take on markets.
It's awesome to be here too.
Excellent. I've been looking forward to our chat for a while. You know, Brooke, in the context of today's shifting sands, how are seasonal trends either propping up or conversely tamping down equities?
Well, actually, the seasonal trends have gotten back into rhythm again. So we've seen that over the last couple of years. So after COVID, the stimulus money, and we saw the economy do extremely well coming out of that. We saw a strong bull market. But now we're sort of digesting all that, and it's sending out a whole bunch of confusing signals in the economy. And right now, I think we're moving back into that period. And we have seen the last couple of years where the seasonal trends, both on the six-month cycle, you know, people know that as a sell in May, which is basically that the stock market tends to perform weaker in the 6 months from early May to late October compared to the other 6 months of the year. So that's actually worked out for the last few years quite well. And we're seeing with the sectors as well, that we're back into this typical seasonal pattern as well. So now that we're past that whole COVID stimulus, coming back from that, you know, all that money being absorbed, we're starting to see the seasonal patterns actually work quite well.
So when you're looking at this, maybe this is an overly simplified question. What comes first, the cart or the horse?
I think macro factors have been really driving this market. What I mean by that is interest rates, movement of interest rates, Federal Reserve balance sheet, and that whole plumbing system with how much liquidity is being put in the market. Liquidity has been a huge factor here. We've seen that increase dramatically after COVID, which really boosted the market. So we've seen all of those, you know, a long time ago, we used to talk about PE ratios.
I mean, you know, feels like a long time ago.
That was like, yeah, a few decades ago, it seems like. So we don't see much of that anymore. And people are more interested in how, if the interest rates move, how is that going to affect the stocks or sectors that I'm looking at? And you're seeing all sorts of reports come out on that type of analysis as well. I think that's going to continue to happen as well. But seasonality really fits in well with this because we do see some sort of relationship between the two of when some of the macro factors actually move and how they actually change. You know, so for instance, interest rates tend to have a seasonal pattern as well. And now it's important to establish what we mean by seasonality, because seasonality basically says is a trend that works on average over the long term, you know, for certain months of the year, certain, you know, a sector of the market might go up or interest rates might go down or a currency might adjust. And it's based upon some sort of causational factor. And, you know, if there's a war or two or whatever it is, those things can actually, you know, totally overwhelm that, like anything. Okay. And so we're really looking at trying to increase probabilities by saying this is what tends to happen at this time. And so we do see seasonality fitting in with these events, unless something big, huge comes along. Like if Powell comes out tomorrow and says, hey, we're going to cut, you know, our federal funds rate by 2%, you know, total surprise, that would change the whole dynamics, of course. But we do see the seasonality actually working well in this environment.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously, there's probably a closer link to technicals than fundamentals, right?
No, I agree with that, because that's something we do track, because it's not like we say, okay, let's go and take a look. Here's the seasonality for the energy sector, and here are the dates. You know, here's where it starts and here's where it ends. You buy on this date and you sell it on this date, or you exit or reduce your position. I mean, that has worked historically, but what we'll say is, look, you know, like for instance, this year, you know, we saw the energy sector turn up higher, better, start to see some improved momentum before in January. So that's a position you'd say, okay, I want to get in early on that. And the same with on the exit date. So you could say, well, look, you know, early May is the exit date. But if it starts to taper off a little bit, then perhaps you start to reduce that position. And that's really what you're trying to do with seasonality is use the technicals to fine tune that or turbocharge that whole process. But the fundamental driving screen really is the seasonals on that. And sometimes it works out exactly, you know, and that's great when it does happen. As an example, if we take a look at 2023, the bottom of the market in October was October 27th.
Right.
Now, my dates for to increase your equity position, you know, for the best 6 months of the year that I established back in 1999, my date is October, from the period is October 28th until May 5th. So we're actually just getting to the end of that. We can talk about that in a second.
I mean, it just...
It was bang on, because you, to get into the market, you actually buy a market close on October 27th, which was the low right there. So it doesn't work out like that all the time, but sometimes it does. But what I'm trying to say is there's usually this period around those entry and exit dates. And it worked out. And go back to 2022, actually, is interesting enough. When did the market bottom again? October, right? Just before the strong six-month seasonal period. But we've had peaks in the market in May recently, which is that traditional time when the market tends to stumble. And we saw that in the Toronto. Now, the Canadian stock market was different compared to the U.S. market last right. summer and spring, because we saw the Canadian stock market peak around the May time, exactly, you know, sell in May, and then it went down into October, and October's low. The U.S. market had a different experience because of AI. Remember right. all the AI hype that really all of a sudden just blossomed? That all took place in like May and June of last year. So here we are in that week or 6 months of the year. We saw the S&P 500 rally up, but it did come back and it was negative within the period that I have for the seasonal week time for the stock market overall. Yeah.
I mean, that the timing of the AI, that's kind of an event driven. It's almost like like an exogenous surprise, you know, to the market, as opposed to not a shock, but obviously the opposite. You know, something that the market obviously was delighted about and showed it. And we're coming up on May now, right? I mean, here we are at the end of April, and, you know, we've already seen pressure on Magnificent Seven stocks. And, you know, some very, obviously they're all notable names, but, you know, the most recent one, of course, to take a drubbing is Meta this past week. And I think on the heels of that, there was very positive reports from two of the other components of the seven. What are your thoughts on, you know, the voices in the market that come out and say, you know, that the seasonality stuff is nonsense? Like when people say, oh, you know, There's obviously imperatives at work in the market, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the dealers, the traders, you know, those who have a vested interest in it not being correct, for whatever reason. And, what are your thoughts on, like, you must get frustrated at times to see the voices in the market saying that, oh, seasonality doesn't work.
Yeah, so that's, you're absolutely right, and I do have a lot of time.
That's hard
in the markets.
You know, that's yeah. Like, investing is, you know, I always say investing is simple and not easy, and, you know, I think seasonality, you know, the point of seasonality of what you do is to point out, you know, there's pitfalls here and there, and there are also rewards here and there, you know, for acting on these seasonal trends. And so, you know, as a proponent of seasonality, as a strong proponent of seasonality, what's your counter argument to the skepticism around it?
Well, for number one, it works.
Well, I'll second that, because, you know, I look at, you know, every time, you know, we're going to talk, every time we've gotten ready to have, you know, to talk to each other, I'll go and check, you know, the chart for HAC. So in the in HAC, in the Global X seasonal rotation ETF, anybody looking at the chart, it's impressive. I mean, since 2009, November of 2009, so you're almost at 15 years since inception, a $10,000 investment has risen to just shy of $30,000. That's assuming, obviously, that you held it from day one and your $10,000, you know, investment was untouched. But, you know, when you compare the volatility of the ETF that you're advising, it's substantially better than many, many, many equity funds out there. Just in the sense that the you know, the drawdowns are, you know, I think the worst drawdown in the whole chart was 2020, and you know, I think it went from 22 to 18, which wasn't really, you know, it wasn't reflective of what was actually happening in the market. If you know, and I, you know, maybe I'm going into too much detail about the the look of the chart, but I just find that I find the chart astonishing to look at because it has such a well-defined trend line as an alternative to everything else that they own. Like, you know, it appears to be a terrific complement to all the traditional equity funds and ETFs that are out there, because it behaves like equity funds, like the traditional equity funds, but also very unlike them at the times when you want them to, you know, at the times when you want HAC to behave and do what was intended, it actually has behaved in a way that's very favorable, or that investors should actually consider very favorable. Like, oh wow, that's not bad at all. Like, it, you know, the equity market went down 50% or 40%, and you know, my HAC only went down, you know, what is that, 15 to 20%?
Yeah, so if we take a look back, and you're right, it's not just about quantity right. of returns, it's also about quality right. of returns. And, you know, you're touching on that because the drawdowns have been, on average, much less than the market. And the worst year we've had overall for a whole year is down 5.5%
right.
Over the 14 and a half years. So
yeah,
by the way,
just covering, I'm covering the drawdown, you know, in the spring of 2020. I'm not covering...
Yeah, we went down approximately, in that case, we went down approximately, depending on the market, around market. Yeah. But typically on all the other drawdowns, we've actually been less on the big drawdowns. Mm-hmm. And that's provide that really good quality right. of return. And so we've seen a standard deviation for HAC that's less than the market. And so investors have appreciated that and said, wow, you know, like I like it when, you know, the fund hasn't gone down as much as the market on this as an experience go. That, and hence the standard deviation has been substantially less than the broad market. By the way, to my knowledge, the HAC is the oldest active equity ETF.
That's right. That's another feather in your cap. I mean, in terms of having been around, but it's astonishing, Brooke. So kudos to you, because I think the performance, the profile, the way that it behaves, it's doing exactly what investors hope and want their investments to do.
Let me go back to, you know, what you're talking about selling may not going and not working.
That was what I was going to say. Sorry, Brooke. So my point is that, you know, to your point, it works. The chart says it works. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just the chart that says it for HAC, but if we take a look at seasonality, let's say, for instance, the 6-month cycle, historically, it has worked well. And so I think a lot of this, you know, if you take a look at the beginning of May, you'll see a lot of articles in the media will come out and say, hey, sell in May. Should you use it this year? No, it doesn't work. They say the same thing every year. And there's a lack of understanding of how it works.
Right.
Okay. And so if you break down from 1950 to 2023, the returns for the S&P 500, using the S&P 500, by decade, every single decade, the returns from October 28th to May 5th are better than the returns from May 6th to October 27th, so right. the other 6 months, every single decade on average. And that's the point, is that the 6 months we're just finishing up now tends to be better than the next 6 months. And so, you know, the 6 months we've just been in or just finishing up, that's when you put your foot on the gas pedal. You know, as far as beta goes, within your risk tolerances, of course, but you put your foot on the gas pedal. In the next 6 months, you pull back.
Right.
You take your foot off the gas pedal a little bit. And there's still opportunities on a seasonal basis as well, because, you know, gold tends to perform well in that period, utilities, consumer staples, the stock market actually can run into earnings. So there's other seasonal opportunities. So it's not like sell in May, gone fishing for 6 months and right. come back. And historically, that has actually, over the long term, produced a good return profile, but there's still other opportunities there.
And I think in a nuanced way, the other thing that might get missed is the rebalancing alpha, right? I mean, there's the alpha that you get from rebalancing out of, like, you're going to shift assets in this time frame that we're in right now, this transition period that we're in from buy in October to sell in May, into other assets in the fund. So when you're not just buying and selling one asset and then taking the profit and running with it, you're shifting those assets that you've rebalanced. You carry that forward each time.
Yes, absolutely. Right? So yeah, you're absolutely right. So it's a different equity profile from sectors. Right. So we'll be in different sectors of the market. Generally, over the next 6 months, we see some of the defensive sectors performing better. Like, as an example, consumer staples tends not to perform very well, let's say January, right? There's other sectors that tend to perform well, like technology in that time period. But coming up right now, and we're actually seeing an improvement with consumer staples. It's already started a strong seasonal period. So it's a different sector profile. And that's why we have rotation in the title of the fund, because it's all about rotation from one sector to the other. And the good thing is nothing against value managers at all. But if you have a value profile, you sort of marry that position until something dramatically changes. If something goes down, you go, well, it's better value, so I can't get out. Whereas, from our approach, we're in a position for a while, where it tends to perform well, and then we move on. So if we never get really in love with a position, it's not like, okay, we love this position, we're going to hold this forever and say, this is, Canadian banks or, gold or whatever it is, that we're going to say, well, this is it. This is we still will be in that sector when it tends to perform well, but then we'll exit it, when it tends to underperform.
Well, that's the benefit of being quantitative and systematic, right? Is not becoming emotionally tied to any particular investment and being agnostic about it, actually.
We all have to strive. That's something every investor within their discipline should strive for, is to become unemotional. But this is one of the disciplines that allows you.
We're talking very lightly, but it's extremely difficult. So that's what makes this so special, is that what you're doing is not, you have to simplify it in order to be able to explain it to the average investor, advisors, what actually makes it work, the nuts and bolts of it, and the agnostic decision making, is what really is the byproduct of the strategy. It's the discipline to just, make a blanket decision and say, okay, we're getting out of this sector now, and we're going to get back into it after this much time, and have that all programmed so that it happens as a matter of process, not the psyche, not emotional, not any sort of emotional bent. And I would also assume that it's difficult at times to ignore, you don't want to ignore the process. I mean, that's the whole point of having a process, is to stick to the process. But there must be times as a human being, Brooke, where you're looking at a run in a particular sector and saying, we have to get out of this. We have to underweight this thing, come hell or high water. It doesn't matter, what happens. We're going to just systematically cut this holding. I mean, are there any instances where you've decided against the programming?
No. So actually, we adhere to the it's not... It's more than programming.
That's good.
But we put windows on it. So when I say, let's say we have an exit date for something, we could go up to 6 weeks longer if we have a positive technical profile of price momentum. So we start to reduce the position, and then we'd say, this is the final date where we get out of this sector, and here we are, or that position. we have to be out. It doesn't matter if we love it, whatever it is. We try not to love it.
You always have a drop dead date where you're, yeah. You
always have a drop dead date. And sometimes it hurts. Like, for instance, yeah, right
that's
now.
The part that's hard, right? Is the constant pain of making these systematic decisions.
Oh, yeah. And this can be times where you say, well, I wish we could be in there. But it's a long-term discipline. For instance, as an example, you know, we were in gold bullion, right. You know, in December into January into February, you know, and we were held past the end of a seasonal period and we said, here's the date. We didn't see that price momentum take off. And all of a sudden, so now we sell it. You know, we were positive at the time, but now we sell it and all of a sudden gold starts to skyrocket. It's like, whoa, you know, I wish we could have had that, but it doesn't matter. It's outside of that window and we have to adhere to what we say, because the worst thing you can do is to start to break, you know, the mandates and the rules. And so you have to follow with what you have. And March and April tend not to be, on average, strong months for the gold sector, you know, and the fact that they're strong now, we could get into why it is, and you know, you've got non-Western central banks buying gold and everything else. But the fact that they're doing well in this period, for us, we say, well, that's great. We're not participating in this because it's not within what we've defined previously, but it's showing strength of the sector in this time period. And so we have another strong seasonal period coming up in July for gold, which means we sort of could, you know, at the end of May, start to take a look. June tends to be a very volatile month for gold. So we'll really take a look at for some big drops in gold price in June, and that tends to be what we prefer. But the fact that we're seeing the strength at this time is really an indication that gold has some underlying strength. And it's, you know, it's surprising everybody with what's taking place. And that is increasing the probability that it's going to perform well in its strong seasonal period, which is coming up really not that
far
away.
A few months away, that's right. So let me the S&P 500, it has broken its upward trend. What's in store for the S&P 500 in terms of your outlook? Mm.
So you're absolutely right. We have seen the S&P 500 break its upward trend, which is not a good signal. Typically, you know, May 5th is the date, and sometimes you see a strong market with strong momentum taking place, and you go, you know, how much equity within the mandates and the parameters that we establish, how much can you actually hold past that date, right, for a few weeks after, because, you know, to take advantage of that. That's a signal that perhaps it's best to start de-risking a little bit early this year. Yeah. Look, as an investor, you can never pick a top and you can never pick a bottom, or you shouldn't expect to. It happens once in a while, but so it's a process. And with that signal, it says perhaps you should actually start to pull back on the beta in a portfolio in that case. And my expectations are for the market coming up over the next 6 months. I think we're going to have a 6 month weaker period overall in the market from what I'm looking at. You know, one of the factors has been the fact that the S&P 500 has broken its upward trend line, but there are other factors. I know we had a couple strong results from the technology companies, but really, we've seen the technology company sector underperform or perform at market. Really, if we could look at the relative graph on the two, we'd have to go back to like November. And then when the peak really was in January. So we've seen the technology sector actually pull back here. With a strong technology sector that's outperforming, you tend to find this really excitement that takes place in the market can really run up further. But with the performance, when we've seen strong days or a couple days for the technology sector, that's it. We've seen the technology sector pop up and then, you know, really come back and perform at market or below market from that. So we're seeing a few signs out there that are saying, well, you know, in this market that perhaps it's best to start to cut back on the beta. And that's exactly what we've been doing at this time. So it's earlier than normal. Last year, as an example, we held later with our equity positions. Further, but this year it makes sense. But this 6 months coming up, I do expect, you know, some uncertainty in the markets as well. I mean, we're finding that the COVID money that, you know, passed out, you know, increased through liquidity and through different parts of society and all that sort of stuff is running out. And so that's one of the factors. And if we look at what's happening in the whole plumbing system with liquidity, with the reverse repo program in the States, it's going to be depleted soon. Like, we're seeing a whole bunch of different moving pieces that say there's not a lot of to really push this market higher at this time. And we're not seeing the market really show that really strong, sustained strength at this time as well. Now, there's another factor as well, is that, you know, we have an election in the U.S. I'm not going to get into the politics of it, but, you know, if we take a look, historically speaking, in the few months leading up to the election, you know, over the summer months, there's uncertainty around an election. And if there's one election that's uncertain, it's this one in the U.S. You know, with both parties, there's a lot of uncertainty. And I don't think that's really been factored into the markets, because there's so much stuff going on all over the place right now that nobody's really taking a look at that. I think that's going to come up here in a month or two, where all of a sudden we're going to start to see investors go, oh yeah, the election, yeah. And so I think the typical pattern is that we see some flatness to down negative markets going into at least September. And when there's, you know, there's seems to be some certainty resolved in October, we start to see the markets start to rally, or, you know, right in early November, in that time period as well. I don't see that us deviating from that pattern, because I do see a lot of uncertainty. So right now I don't see a big potential for the stock market to perform well over the next 6 months.
That covers your sell in May period, right? Which ends October 27th. And you know, that's the election. That's the run up to the election. I mean, a week before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could time perfectly as far as that goes. I mean, maybe it is in September, you know, maybe it's late September, maybe it's early October, but in that time period, you're absolutely right. And I want to point out, because one of the big things you don't want to miss is you don't want to miss large returns.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to do something and go, hey, you know what? I all of a sudden the market runs away from you in a big way. And so we're cognizant of that in seasonality. If you take a look in the period from May 6th to October 27th, that week or 6 month period, the S&P 500 from 1950 has only produced returns of 10% or greater 8 times. All 8 times have been off of recessions.
Right.
Or coming off of a recession-like condition and rapid growth in the economy. We are not in that scenario. We might be heading into a recession, but we're not coming out of a recession where, you know, you find small caps just take off and there's rapid growth in the economy and the GDP is over 5%. We're not in that scenario. You know, so there's a lower risk in this time from a seasonal period, exposing yourselves to a massive, you know, all of a sudden, you know, we see a big huge run in the market. It does not tend to happen. But if you measure that compared to the other 6 months of the year from October 20th to May 5th, 10% or greater returns 28 right. times. That's where you get the big returns. So the next 6 months is more of big losses. That's where the feature of that
yeah.
period versus the last 6 months, big returns.
I'm always fascinated by that. Now, as we enter the May period, the post, you know, May and then in the May to October period, where do you see, like, the corollary to a weaker equity market would be fixed income? Where do you see the bond market going between, or how do you see the bond market performing seasonally between now and October?
Yeah, so you raise a good point, though, because there is a relationship between the fixed income and bonds. You know, let's take a look at government bonds. Government bonds tend to perform well from May 6th, so right. just around the corner, until really into early October, just October 3rd. So you find that on average, on the margin, you find some investors will rotate out of equities as they, risk tolerance changes, right, in this period, they rotate into fixed income or government bonds, which tends to give government bonds a boost. Now, there's a lot of other pieces moving at this point. You know, the U.S. government has said, well, you know, we're just going to have a huge deficit, you know, and it just doesn't matter to them, period. You know, but at the same time, we're seeing a slowing economy, and then we have inflation being sticky. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, but that doesn't negate the strong seasonal period for government bonds. So, you know, you can't, it all boils down to using the technicals to really take a look at how the market's actually interpreting that information, because especially when it's opposing each other. And you'd say, well, is there any strength in the fixed income? And we've seen the yield on 10-year treasury rate recently rise to 4.7%. Here we are getting closer and closer to 5%, which I think would be a big problem for the equity market. But, you know, I think at this point, it's still, you could see government bonds actually perform quite well in this strong seasonal period. I don't see a huge amount of new government spending coming into the elections. It'd be very difficult to say, yes, I think they're being irresponsible how much is being spent, but I don't see all of a sudden a big, huge boost coming along because, you know, I don't think that's the way it goes before elections. The other party doesn't want to give, you know, the one party a lot more, you know, voting power, so to speak. So I think the factors we know about says that we still could see, you know, government bonds do okay. And particularly in August and September, that's the real sweet spot for that trade at this time.
Brooke, that seems almost serendipitous given, you know, how yields have been climbing. They're making the 10s and 30s increasingly attractive again. Is it just a coincidence? I mean, that it's matching up very nicely with the seasonality? Tactically, it's looking very interesting, right?
Yeah, so we're seeing some signs that actually could work out quite well. If we take a look at the market, you know, I talked about technology really performing at market, underperforming since January. And so where have investors been going? So they went into the cyclical parts of the market for a while. So you found industrials, materials actually performing really well, energy performed well. And so you found those outperforming the S&P 500. What we're seeing recently over the last few weeks is we're seeing money flow out of the technology sector, barring the last couple of days, but flow out of that sector. And where are they going? They're going to the defensive sectors. So we've seen the utility sector do extremely well. And that's in a rising rate environment, right? Like wow. Consumer staples, healthcare, all of those sectors have been outperforming the S&P 500 the last few weeks. They all have either started their strong seasonal period or about to very shortly. And so that's a sign when you're seeing investors, they're becoming more defensive at this point. Before they're rotating and they said, look, I really want to be, the market's still there, the growth, the industry's still going. I want to be part of that. And that's why they went to the cyclicals. At this point, they're still saying, I want to be invested. Right. But I want to be more defensive. And so we're seeing that in the defensive sectors, but that's spilling over, as you say, into some of the fixed income where they're taking on bigger and bigger positions.
Well, I mean, if you look at the rising yields in the 10s and 30s, it shows, you know, basically money leaving fixed income, right? So, you know, investors tend to do the exact opposite. I'm sure there's a cadre of investors who are, you know, who are backing up into these longer term bonds because of the increasingly attractive yields. But the yield, it's not just the yields that are increasingly attractive. It's what happens on the other side of what happens on the other side with yields falling again at some point. But that's an additional attraction. But investors who have been in long duration bonds are still, you know, smarting from the pain sure. of the run up in yields. I think this has been a difficult year institutionally for companies in the ETF and fund space. Where do we go next? When does this, you know, when do these scenarios unfold? I think a lot of fund companies actually held off on making calls in this market. Any particular area of the bond market that you like?
Typically, we tend to focus on the midterm bonds as far as I go, the notes, the 7 to 10 year notes. As far as that goes, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's a huge difference between the long end of the curve, and the short end of the curve, because the Federal Reserve really controls like the short right. end. That's where the maximum impact, if they cut rates on the federal funds rate, you know, you really are affected like 2 years and under, but like the 30 year, that's not so much. That's more about the economy. What's happening with the economy? Is it growing? And what about inflation? That's weighing out there. So it's a totally different part of the market. I mean, the Federal Reserve, obviously with quantitative easing right. or quantitative tightening, can control that a little bit, but not much, unless it's a huge, huge, huge program. So, I mean, typically I think, you know, try not to, you know, get too involved with that whole process on either end. The midterms, you know, actually sort of work.
Well, yeah, they have less volatility, well. And they provide, and right now they're providing nearly the same yield. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I want to point out too, though, you know, I've done some studies in the past a long time ago, and, you know, when does the bond market bottom around this time? And so if the stock market peaks, you know, I did, you know, scatter diagrams of the different years when it peaked in early May, which is on average, you know, the seasonal right. time. Usually the bond market bottoms within the next couple weeks, you know, after that.
So now we're talking like just after May 6th, like May 14th.
Yeah, so we don't know really, you know, has the stock market peaked already? You know, when it broke that trend line, is it going to go back up again? But if we start to see the downward pressure on the stock market, because we have seen a little bit of last week was negative, and we're positive this week, but we start to see a downward trend. And, you know, the narrative switches in the stock market. If that takes place, it's usually within a couple weeks that we start to see that bottoming process. So in other words, you know, it's, as far as the timing of it goes, I mean, there could be some sort of buffer zone as far as that goes, is you know, at least an opportunity range.
Right.
And like I said, the sweet spot for us really is from a seasonal point of view from in August and September. It starts in late July. So after the earnings season gets well underway, that's when it tends to really start to do well. You know, and depending on what your strategy is, you know, you could start stepping in, you know, when the seasonal period starts in May, and then increase that later on as the sweet spot of the trade comes up. But there was other sectors in the market
that was
beyond
what
bond.
I wanted to ask you about is, you know, what sectors do well during the May to October period?
Yeah, so generally speaking, it's the defensive sectors
right.
can do quite
and
well.
Then,
but it's more than that. It's like, for instance, the biotech sector tends
right.
to perform well from June 23rd into mid-September. And July tends to be the best month of the year by far for the biotech sector. And there's a number of reasons why that takes place. You know, it's ahead of all the conferences that take place in the fall time, et cetera, et cetera. So that's not a defensive sector, but here we have it. It tends to actually perform quite well in that time period. Gold tends to perform well. It's actually a strong seasonal period at that time coming up. So the healthcare sector overall has a strong seasonal period in
right.
May and June. Biotech sector just starts a little bit later, but there's different dynamics driving it. But once again, you know, particularly around the shoulder season, what I call it, you know, May and June,
right.
gold miners, if you want to get back to that sector as well,
right.
also have a strong seasonal period coming up in July again. And then we find that the energy sector finishes its strong seasonal period that it's in right now. It finishes it in early May. It can go into June. But here's the sector, you know, we talked about get out dates type of thing. This is one sort of has a hard stop, even if you hold it past May into June, because June is the worst month of the year for the energy sector
right.
overall.
And is that because of the season?
So it's one of so what drives the whole trade for energy is, you know, the biggest consumption of oil and gas takes place starting
right.
with driving season. In the Northern
exactly.
Hemisphere, we dramatically increase our usage. And that starts in May. So that's why the energy sector tends to perform well from February until May. So seasonal investing, we call it seasonal investing, but it's really a behavioral
right.
investing. You know, we're taking advantage of investor behavior. So, you know, I'm not the only one that knows that the refinery shut down in February and May to do their maintenance and switch from winter gas to summer gas. And then you have a big, huge pull And so investors want to be in there for that, so that they tend to get in March and April. And then what, from a seasonal perspective, is you want to be in before they get in.
Right.
And when they all get in, you want to get out. So it's not what's happening in the underlying. It's how investors are behaving. That's what you're taking.
Yeah.
You're arbitraging investor behavior.
It's not, example. So I know you're clarifying that it's got nothing to do with the seasons of the year. It has to do with the season of investing, the behavior.
Yes. Of when investors get excited about a possible event. Like, for instance, the retail sector. Most investors don't want to get involved in the retail sector in June, July. Like, to them, it's dead money. They're saying, well, why am I putting my money to work here? Because there's not a strong catalyst for it to move. They're much more interested in being in the retail sector for Black Friday. So then they start to take the positions ahead of Black Friday in November. So the best time to buy into that sector is actually in late October, before everybody else gets excited about it. They all get excited about it, and then you sell.
Yeah.
You actually sell on Black Friday or the day before or around Black Friday. So it doesn't really matter what happens to this, whether the sales are good or bad. You're taking advantage of investor behavior because of how they're actually participating in the market.
And again, it's one of those things, you know, buying on mystery and selling on history is one of those things that sounds like a great idea. It sounds like a simple, you know, investing concept. Like buy low and sell high, but so few investors actually are able to do it. Like, I think the benefit of what you do, Brooke, is that you're talking about a seasonal investing strategy that, of course, any retail investor can undertake to do themselves with your help, with your guide. But at the same time, you know, if I know you're running a fund and it's your expertise behind advising that fund on what to do and doing it systematically, you know, why wouldn't I just, why do it myself? I could figure it out. It's a fascinating, you know, I can see where a lot of investors can take it on as a serious hobby, especially, you know, in the DIY market. But if I have the opportunity to just engage you as the advisor to the fund, then why wouldn't I just do that?
Yeah, it's in this case, this is not a closet index approach.
It's like
at
to me,
all.
It's as intricate as, you know, a strategy like covered call overlay. It has the complexity. It has a lot of complexity and timing and you know, again, like I you know, you can see where people might take this on as a hobby, but why not buy the ETF?
Yeah, so from that perspective, from a whole product solution, that actually makes the most sense just because it's so active. It's, you know, we're taking advantage of a seasonal trade that tends to be, you know, on average 2 to 3 months and then going to something else. And it's almost impossible for an average person to do that portfolio strategy. But investors can still use this and still reference it. Like, for instance, you say, well, you know, when's the best time to be in gold? I really, you know, I'm thinking about getting into gold. Let me take a look from a seasonal perspective.
Right, as a timing assistance. Like, you know, if I want to get out of something, should I wait till the end of the favorable holding period? If I want to get into something, should I wait till it's seasonally favorable?
Yeah, it's telling you which parts of the market tend to do well at certain times. So the sandbox to play in or where some favorable investments might be. You know, like if it's January, look, I'm interested in the energy sector. Oh, this is when it tends to do well. I'm going to increase the probability of success by getting in at this time. So, yeah, so yes, from a portfolio perspective, and you're absolutely right, it can add a lot of value and complement other funds because it's such a different approach. And the other thing too is we've talked a lot about equities, we talked a little bit about fixed income, we talked about gold and oil, but all of these sectors have seasonal periods, basically, or asset classes, I really should say. So it's in the fund, we're actually using a multi-asset approach. Because, so we're adding a diversification layer, you know, for instance, you know, we, as far as the currencies go, overweight the US dollar at certain times, because it has a strong seasonal period, or fixed income, or, you know, some of the commodities. I mean, most of the returns, the performance profile is driven by equities, but you do get a benefit of having this multi-asset approach across the board within the fund itself. And investors can still use all that as well on their own, say, oh, when's a good time to actually get right. US dollars or whatever it is. But
yeah, it's useful on it's useful on a one-off, you know, on any one-off basis as well. It doesn't mean that you're as a do-it-yourself investor, you're going to, or any investor, you're going to pick up your book and start becoming a full-blown active seasonal investor. You could technically, but again, yeah. You know, the systematization is critical because those behavioral mistakes, you know, it's very hard for us as human beings to get around them. It's more difficult. I think it's more difficult than investors realize. Any of the things that we've talked about, or that it seems to me like, you know, that's what makes the investing business so fascinating, is that it's, you know, there's always uncertainty. Sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less. You know, it's the certainty that's absurd, right?
Yeah, and it's never the same. I mean, you know, we say, oh, this time it's different. You know, the famous four words, but, and maybe it is the same, but it's never the same. It's because exactly the same. Maybe there's some elements in there. And that's what we're trying to do with seasonality, is we're trying to say, well, you know, where's the rhyming of this? Like, you know, what sectors, like home builders, tend to have permits at some time of the year and tend to get built at a certain time of the year as well. And that hasn't changed, but there are some changes that have happened with seasonal, you know, for sectors of the market as well. So there's always changes taking place, which makes this whole investing fascinating. Like, I mean, that's what keeps us all interested. I mean, sometimes it hurts and sometimes it's very rewarding, but it's a fascinating process. For all of us. And I can tell you, over the long term, seasonality has actually handled that quite well. As the market's changed, we've gone through different, let's call them regimes, you know, where we've gone through a slowdown in the economy, or we've gone through, you know, quantitative easing. Seasonal investing, actually, you still find this, the sectors of the market tend to perform well in their seasonal periods on average. So it doesn't negate that at all. And sometimes it's more favorable. And I think we're coming up to time. We started a time period now where it is more favorable. And I think that's going to continue. But there's always going to be nuances as we go forward.
So Brooke, before we draw to a close here, my question for you is, in your conversations, what has been something that has dominated the conversation?
Yeah, I think investors are trying to figure out what's driving this market now, because everything's changing so much as far as the Federal Reserve goes. I mean, we've gone from this quantitative easing into, you know, quantitative tightening and raising rates. And there's more of an interest on the macro level than ever before, because there used to be this perception in the investment community. Look, economics.
Yeah, we had a long stretch of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. It just doesn't matter. The economy, and to a degree, they're absolutely right. The economy can be doing one thing for a while and the stock market doing something else. But some of the factors like inflation and interest rates are really driving this market on a real-time basis right now. And that's frustrating for a lot of people, because, you know, they say, I want to own a good company and that's what I want to focus on, or I have a process I want to focus on. And they're seeing this take place. So they're finding that a little bit challenging, right. As far as that process goes. I'd say that's a big one. I mean, seasonality does help with that, because it puts an overlayer on it and says, look, you know, here's, this actually works within that framework. But I think that's a big thing that investment advisors, you know, has to adapt to, I think, a little bit, is really the drivers of the market have been changing of what works and what doesn't work. And it's become a lot of the economic issues, a lot more sensitivity to that.
What I understand is that, and to your point, is that the things that are going on in the market are not trouncing seasonality, and seasonality is not trouncing the market. It's they're you know, seasonality has been a constant.
Yes.
It's something you can count on.
Yeah. And the seasonality has worked well. And I think, you know, here we are, you know, on the verge of this coming up to May, you know, right now. And here we are entering what I call the 6-month unfavorable period for the stock market. Now, there are sectors of the market that do well, as we discussed. And on average, you know, this is a weaker time for the market. But I don't know for sure if that's the case.
Well, you never know for sure,
but
yeah.
You never know.
Yeah.
You never ever know, and that you just don't. And that's where you have to rely upon a long-term model and a discipline and being able to, whatever it is, you have to be comfortable with that to say that this is how this works over the long term. And yes, it worked last year. And yes, it worked the year before. Right. It probably won't work this year, but it doesn't necessarily mean it will. And so it's managing that whole process. On a go forward basis, but I will say, you know, with what's taking place, I think it's the whole seasonal framework is going to work even better over time, over the next decade than what we've seen over the last decade as well. I mean, it's worked well, but I think it's going to work even better because I think we're going to see a market that's changing about what sectors of the market work well. And so you're going to see a more technology has been absolute dominance, you know, really over the last number of years. You know, there's a year like 2022 where it went down, but other than that, we're all going to, you know, use AI and all that sort of stuff, but I don't see that being the same dominant factor over the next 10 years. I think we're going to see other sectors of the market participate more. And I think that'll be a benefit for seasonal investing.
Brooke, thank you so much. I mean, what a conversation. I'm always fascinated by seasonality as a strategy. I don't know if this is something that you feel the same way, but I wish investors paid more attention to this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because before I wrote my first book, by the way, back in 1999, like that was a long time ago. But, you know, back then when I talked about seasonality, nobody would talk about it. You know, it was because we were in the tech bubble, right? And so it was all about eyeballs on the screen. They have different metrics about how they're measuring stuff. And it's just, there was just no interest in it. There was no interest in, you know, a bunch of stuff. But seasonality was just like, oh, we just don't want to hear about it. And over time, though, we've seen investors actually start to really become accustomed to this. So if you BNN, Bloomberg, or CNBC, you find more and more people talking about seasonality and about, hey, this is good. And it tends to be the strong seasonal period. I didn't hear that.
It's true. I've noticed it
as well. Didn't hear it.
Yeah.
But I will say, so that's, it has really had its, you know, comeuppance on that. But I will say that most people don't know how to apply it properly. So there's one thing to know something, but it's also be able to execute it, you know, to be able to take advantage of something. And so I find a lot of talk about it, but not really without robust data set and being able to say, here's how to take advantage of it.
Fascinating, Brooke. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight today. It's been great catching up with you.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed our chat.